Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all characters and styles and their enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're exploring writing fiction. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome, everyone, to our Inside Story Goldster Conversation, where today we are going to journey with one of our finest novelists of their generation to discuss the moral compass, faith, and our society. What is and what is not acceptable? And what do we do when lines are crossed in our personal lives? The work of my guest today has been praised by none other than Philip Pullman for his tackling important and pertinent themes, and by the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, for testing the reader's own moral alertness for rigor, realism, and generosity. Now, the question of faith runs really through all his 13 books. But what is faith? Do we all have it to some extent? It's not God, it's not necessarily the Bible, but what is it? Is it entwined with our human condition? Big questions and great reads. The latest book is simply called The Choice, A Vicar, An English Village, A Bell Ringer, and A Discovery. And that's all you're going to get from me, because Michael Arditti, welcome to Goldster Inside Story.
Thanks very much. I hope they'll get a little bit more from me but I'm very happy to be here and to discuss the work and the main ideas behind it.
Yes, I like ideas, but before we get to that, we have to get to imagery, Michael. Now, your author picks have you as an attractive man with a high intellectual aura, and now we've got you with a beard. Where does that come from?
The intellectual order hasn't sort of disappeared because of the but. I had a very serious onslaught of spinal problems last summer, and I was bedbound for several months, and I couldn't shave. And then by the end of that, I looked like Captain Pugwash with the sort of beard that came out like this. But everybody hated it, but I thought, well, I'm going to take something away from this rather wretched sort of situation. And I had it cut and rather like this. And I thought, well, that's what's going to go into my declining years. I shall have it.
Since we touched on that, a beard or a non-beard, which presents the greatest intellectual aura of ideas, would you say?
If somewhere in one of my early novels, there's a man talking to a therapist and says he hates people with beards because he thinks they're trying to hide something. And so maybe actually you have to be more open and free, and with just everything should be clean shaven. I don't know. It's interesting that the early portraits of Christ, the very earliest ones in the catacombs in Rome, he's always clean shaven. And of course, through the medieval period and after that, he had a beard because beard was a sign of masculine authority. And indeed, some pictures of some women rulers have been, they've had beards added to them to give the sense that they were actually authority figures. I wouldn't go that far. But
I like this. Just, we could go way off on a tangent here. So beards are a sort of a message of power, but not necessarily of high intelligence. But we can leave my conclusion there, because I have another question before we move on. Is that you, as a novelist and a critic, you have been deeply entrenched in the arts all your life, very good communicators, we've just found out. But did you ever, as a little boy, dream of being a fireman or an astronaut or an explorer?
No, I didn't really, and nor was I Boris Johnson dreaming of being king of the world. I always wanted to write. I remember writing little stories almost before I could properly write them down. I was thinking about that the other day because I met somebody who was at prep school with me who reminded me of a sort of book that I was writing, and I think I spent rather more time designing the cover, you know, than that way that kids do, than actually writing the book. But he said it was called The Stone That Missed. Fortunately, this juvenile has completely disappeared. But no, I... I always wanted to write.
And the Stone Mist, what was the idea behind it?
I don't fully remember, but I think it was that somebody had thrown a stone which was supposed to hit something else and hit the sort of sensitive young hero who at 9 was presumably me. But I honestly don't remember more than that. I was amazed that it makes me feel that I must have been going around very vaingloriously saying, here is the novel that I wrote. But that's all I know. I don't remember it at all.
So if the Stone Mist was your first work of creativity, we are going to go to your latest now, which is The Choice, which is a wonderful book. And I am not going to say any more about it than that. But what I'd like you to do is give us a taster, as much as you can without a spoiler, as to what brings us to this idea of The Choice.
It's the protagonist is a woman priest called Clarissa Phipps. I discover that, in fact, she's the first woman priest protagonist in English fiction. Not totally surprising because they haven't been around for that long, but I thought there might be a few more. Mm. Is the rector of a small village in Cheshire called Tapley. And in the church are these rather extraordinary panels that were painted by a very great religious artist, who's often seen as the greatest British religious artist since Stanley Spencer. He's fictitious, called Seward Wemlock. And we discover in the course of the novel that his private life didn't really match his public profession of faith. But she is in this church, and various things happen that force her to decide how she actually acts in both her public role and also in her private life. The first is, and I'll tell this one because it happens at the end of the first chapter, she discovers one of the bell ringers, who's actually the husband of her best friend, caught. She catches him in the bell tower with a boy of 15 in some sort of sexual embrace. The boy claims it's utterly consensual, and in fact that he was the one who instigated it, but she has a very clear duty in terms of her position in the church to report it to the church authorities. This brings up all sorts of problems because of her friendship, because also she knows exactly what she's going to bring about, presumably the ruin of her best friend's marriage. It will also cause huge problems for the 15-year-old boy with his peer group. And we see other members of his peer group. There are quite a few teenagers in the book, and we see how they would respond to this. And it also brings up, I mean, she's living a slightly unconventional marriage with a husband who's only there at weekends, not simply because he's actually a curator of the Tate at the same time, but also because of the way they've decided to split their lives. And while in the course of this and in the course of trying to deal with this issue, we also start to discover things about the painter, Seward Wemlock, which brings in further, even more significant choices about how she responds to the panels in the church, and which brings up this huge question, which is so big at this day, is about cancel culture. When you discover that somebody's private life is not up to the standards you expect of them, as particularly as somebody who's making public art, particularly of religious art, how do you respond? The week the book came out, somebody chipped away at the statue of Prospero and Ariel outside Broadcasting House.
Yes, yes.
Because of it was sculpted by Gill. And Eric Gill, as we know, had a private life that was completely alien to his profession, of his religious profession. He even founded a religious order, his Stations of the Cross through Westminster Cathedral. What do you do about those? Do you leave them and say the art is what matters? Or do you say they're tainted by the artist's private life? And that's perhaps the question.
So you've got two choices. There's the choice, which is the big personal choice that Clarissa has to make, and don't tell us what happened, as to whether to how much she damages the marriage, the bell ringer, the boy, the village, the community, and all that by what she discovered. And then there's a more, I guess, detached choice of what you do with the paintings in the church. I'd like to ask our audience here, if they got any views, what should Clarissa do? Should she keep it to herself, or should she tell the community, get at it? And what do you do about the paintings in the church or Gill's statue and that sort of thing? Give us your views, because that will feed our discussion. Or if we have complete silence, Michael, we'll know that the choice is too tough for anybody to answer. But to get to the personal choice to begin with, if you see something like that that could, if it comes out, damage a lot of things, are you led by your faith, your belief, the moral compass given to you by your faith, or is it better to protect? And is your duty to your community? Are these the issues that you're discussing?
I mean, to a large extent, I mean, Clarissa has a different responsibility than you or I would, because she is a member of the church, and the church has very specific regulations about how she has to behave. Whether she does that or not, I won't say now. But my faith does lead me to how I respond to people. But my faith is a faith that believes in compassion, understanding. I mean, I believe much more in the tu comprends et tu pardonnes version of faith, of morality, than in, you know, the sort of punishing people and stoning them or whatever. Go back to my first novel. In the novel, Clarissa's brother, because I should have said that the first and third sections of the novel, excuse me, are set in 2019, just before COVID, and the section is set in 1987. There's a specific reason for that, but partly because that was the time that women were first ordained as deacons in the church, and right. Clarissa has a vocation, is involved in that, and until then she wasn't able to pursue her vocation or fulfill her vocation. During that period, we meet Clarissa's brother, who is very atheistical, who is a socialist, who's been in Cuba, who's a gay man, who comes back to see his parents and his sister for various reasons. And he asks her, their father is a bishop, which is where she first came to understand the workings of the church. And he asks her, Alexander, his name is, asks her, you know, how do you believe your morality? Where's it come from? Is the church just a comfort blanket for her? My faith comes from God, but my morality comes from being human. And now I believe she does too, that there's a very interconnected, but my morality, the way I hope that I would behave towards people, the way I would understand their problems, their issues, how it would be no different if I were a non-believer. I don't base the way I treat people on their, that doesn't come from my faith.
I have a quote. We have some interesting answers, because to the question that I asked, all in one direction, actually, and you're not going to say what happens in the book, but Pauline says that given that she is the rector stroke vicar, how is there a choice? She needs to deal with it openly, secrets, etc., more damaging. Liz says, well, I hope she'll take the right approach in terms of protecting and safeguarding the young person rather than worrying about friendships, etc. It seems to be quite clear. The duty of care, says Maria, towards youngsters takes priority without doubt. And Liz, once you bend your morals or principles a little to fit in with friends or loved ones, then where is your compass? What do you think about that instant reaction from our audience, Michael?
Well, that's the reaction that many of Clarissa's parishioners have. And that's also a reaction that she has to discover in herself. But we have to make two things. The boy is 15. He's not six. It is against the law. There's no question of that. I mean, they're aware of this. But it's a consensual relationship. And the boy is 15. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm saying there's a big difference in that, I feel, between an abusive relationship with a young child. in some countries, 15 is actually, France, for example, 15 is the age of consent, 14 in some European countries. Yeah. Again, whether that's right or wrong is a different issue on the consent.
And I think we have to find out this is a novel, so you know you are putting all the points of view across so that we can decide. And we're having Liz says 15 is very young. Who has the power? That's an interesting, because there is all this sort of the brainwashing of the young in there. So that's interesting. And Jean Joyce, Jean, we're going to move on to this in a minute. Not sure about Clarissa's choices, but the artwork should be left alone. A lot of artists have murky backgrounds, just like the rest of society. Yes. What a great... And I just like to talk a little bit about, I said it was a novel, but you are writing it. You have created this choice, as it were. You touched on it just now, your concept of faith, religion, your own belief, because there is a strand that runs through all your work. Tell us about that.
Well, I do have a strong religious faith myself.
You're a man of the church.
Man of the church, yeah. But I have, it's also very idiosyncratic. I believe very strongly, we're told, you know, the very beginning of the Bible, if you like, that humankind is made in God's image. If that has any meaning, I mean, even metaphorical meaning, then I have related that in my life. And indeed, this is stated by a character in the book, that there are, you know, three parts to the Trinity in Christian faith: God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. And a character relates those to God the Father as creativity, God the Son as love, and God the Holy Spirit as moral understanding. And I say that those are the three aspects of the divine, the three aspects of the Creator that we all have in ourselves. And so that's where my belief, that's what my belief comes from. I have, particularly in a novel called The Enemy of the Good, explored fundamentalism in that book, in both Christianity and Judaism primarily, but also a bit in Islam, because I think that fundamentalism is the great danger. It's holding up a book and saying, this is the truth. I know the truth. The moment you're saying, and I know God, because the God is in this book. The moment you're saying, I know something, you can't argue. When you say, I believe, you can argue with somebody. And I believe that leaves room for an element of doubt. Doubt is an element. Doubt is part of faith. All great thinkers and religious thinkers have experienced doubt. Christ himself experienced doubts.
So am I right, or you tell me, because I'm not going to tell, is that in creating the choice, and we saw the unequivocal views that came from our audience on the sort of pen picture that you and I painted there, that you are sowing doubt in how they might view that. This is what you've done in the book.
I'm asking them to question some responses. I'm trying to put some nuance into the debate, and also to say very strongly that the lady who said the artwork is sort of different, the art side of it is different from the personal side of it. I'm trying to say, well, yes, but because do we treat artists as differently? Do we treat the fact that somebody has created great work that gives them, as somebody again in the Bible says, a get out of jail free card? Yes. And I'm not saying with that, I mean, the Clarissa's husband, Marcus, is a curator at the Tate. And he is very strongly on the fact that, you know, the art has a power, a reality, an integrity of its own. But at the same time, he's saying, of course, this may not last. He gives the example of Guga and says that he can see a time in the not too distant future where you have to go... into, you know, if you want to see a Gauguin painting, this is an extreme view, but he's saying this, you have to sort of go into a special vault somewhere, rather like when you used to go to the British Library and you used to want to read what they called the forbidden books, and you had to sit at the beady eye of very disapproving curator. But actually, because of Gauguin's undoubted sexual misdemeanors with young girls in Tahiti, his work will not allow it to be shown. We're already seeing aspects of that. And so I'm just trying to put all these things and saying, is the personal different from the artistic? How do we respond on both, on all these different levels?
I mean, it's very interesting because as you were talking that, and a Jimmy Savile came to mind, although not an artist, but a great celebrity who was hailed. And then, you know, when it was discovered what was widely known, everything got ripped down, including, I think, his gravestone, didn't it?
I mean, that's slightly different in the sense that obviously he didn't create that grace. I mean, one might say that Rolf Harris was a painter.
What?
You know, apparently the price of Rolf Harris paintings, because apparently he was, I didn't know this, but he was quite a collectible painter. And the value of the paintings dropped almost overnight. In both those cases, and indeed there are aspects of this in The Choice, those were abusive relationships. Those were relationships with, and they were definitely people using their power, using their celebrity. That was should be utterly condemned. I mean, I didn't know anything about Jimmy Savile's actual behavior, but whenever I didn't see him, but whenever I saw him, I mean, he gave off this most mephitic aura. I found it, but, and yet, you know, he walked with princes and prime ministers.
He did. Yes. I mean, but tell me, when you were writing The Choice, had you decided the ending?
Or
were you sowing doubt into your mind as you wrote it?
I knew that I wouldn't come down on any particular side. I wasn't exactly sure how the novel would actually, you know, what. But I was never going to come down and say, this is how people should behave. I was showing different attitudes to Clarissa, particularly her friends, the friends she had, through her husband, Marcus, who putting the art point of view, through another priest, a very old-fashioned Anglo-Catholic priest called Father Vincent, who has his own ideas of how things should go. And then in the central section, we see her responding to her brother and her father and her mother. And it becomes a little family drama because all those events, all those ideas come out 25 years before, whatever, yes. Different way.
Oh, so we go with Clarissa through the dilemmas and the doubts and how her mind and conscience and faith moves in that swirl, as it were.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
We also sort of vaguely what made her, because in the we see in the second part of the book, particularly she reflects on her childhood, and also we see her in what I think perhaps there are some funny chapters in the book when she is working as a religious producer in BBC Radio because she's unable to fulfill her vocation in the church. And this was the time when religious broadcasting was a much bigger deal than it is today. And it was also a time in the late 80s when the broadcasting was moving from priests who had, or religious people, but particularly priests, who had an interest in broadcasting to broadcasters who had an interest in religion. And so we see that tension there when she's doing that. And that shows other aspects of her.
Life is full of these tensions, isn't it? I want to move on to your previous works in just a second. Pauline Blasey is agreeing with you. A great way of looking at faith, not truth. Liz has, and I think we've done this, moral dilemmas. It's always fascinating to see how a character starts with very clear views, then slowly swayed by other points of views. We can maybe accept the art without accepting or condoning the behavior of the artist. Nice one from Pauline here. There is also a problem that morality itself is not a single absolute because it moves with social conscience.
I would, but I mean, I would, you know, the novel I mentioned earlier on, The Enemy of the Good, that title comes from a Voltaire quote, which is quite well known, which is the best is the enemy of the good. And I use that particularly in terms of the absolutism of some religious belief. You know, only God is absolute. We are relative. You know, we live in a world that changes. We live in a world of time. Everything changes all the time. And the changes, of course, the last 50 years have been greater than those in the 2000 or whatever that preceded us. Our basic morality should be based on various obvious things like compassion, understanding, forgiveness. This is, in my case, of our fellow human beings. But the way we express it and the way we see other people behave, of course, is conditioned by the society we live in. So, yes.
And don't answer this if you don't want to, but what would you say is the biggest and most challenging moral choice that you have faced?
Whether to live or die. But that's as far as I'll go. I mean, in my...
Okay. Well, that's a good one. That set us all on tenterhooks. I want to go down to your first book that was published in 1993 called The Celibate. And the blurb on the back said it delves into the character of a young idealistic ordinant in the Church of England. This is the interesting bit, who only discovers humanity and passion when sent to work among outcasts and down and outs. Now, you would have been a younger man then. What made you debut with this title and this theme?
It was a long time. It's coming up to 30 years ago. And one of the things is I never reread anything, novel or stories that I've written. And so it's a bit of a blur, but I know the basic thing. I was trying to explore a young man who, as you say, an ordinand. He was training to be a priest. He had very certain ideas of himself and his place in the world. And then what happens at the very beginning of the novel is that he is taking part in a communion service, a mass, he would call it, because he's a high Anglican, and he drops the chalice. And to him, that is actually dropping Christ's blood. It's not simply dropping wine that represents Christ's blood. He has a very real presence. His idea is of the real presence in the chalice. This sparks off a nervous breakdown. And having been a very privileged, very secure young man, he's sent by the head of his principal of his theological college to London, where he meets. He goes to work in a sort of centre, like they have in St Martin in the Fields. I don't know if they still have it. There was one in Aldgate that I went to spend some time in to see how it worked. I don't know if it's still there. And meets people with completely different views to himself. He also starts to uncover his own sexuality. And it's also the beginning of the 19... It came out in 1993. I think I must have started writing it in the late 1989, 1990, which is there was a time when AIDS was very, very prevalent and in the head. And he has to, as a gay man, he has to confront this. And the time, you know, you had vicars pointing rifles at their son's head in tabloid newspapers saying, I'd kill him if he had AIDS. Mm. And, you know, where is God in this? And so all these things come on. So suddenly he has to mature. He has to come to terms with the complexities of life, almost as what we were saying before, from having this very absolutist view, slightly challenged by his own sexuality, but now I've remembered he refused to admit it at the beginning of the book because another ordinand says he's in love with him and he rejects him quite cruelly. I'd forgotten about that. And he has to start seeing that this is not the way to behave.
The picture you've painted there is one where the dropping of the chalice and was his direct communication or what he thought was his direct link to God or to Christ, it direct link to his ideology in a way, whereas when he gets amongst the down and outs, he's got the more practical things of making people fed, making sure they're safe, those sort of material things. And that is what matures him.
Yes, that and human relationships.
He had different human relationships when he was
empathetic, becoming understanding, you know, people. The book is entirely written. Well, it's not. It's written in two sorts of way. There are two parts to the book, and the book is entirely written. I'm remembering again. It's as if it's in therapy sessions, This was partly my take on the fact that first novels were always supposed to be, based on the author's life. And they were almost, people who say, it's therapy for the writer, to write
what you know.
And so actually, I thought, I'll take it. This was not my life at all, but I will make it in therapeutic sessions. And at the same time, they're framed in both the first part, they're framed by a walk he has to take for reasons I can't remember exactly. They're good reasons, through Jack the Ripper's London. And the second part, it all takes place, most of the second part takes place in Derbyshire. And it's also, the second part is framed by walking through the plague village of Eyam, which was the one place outside London that was affected very badly by the Great Plague in 1665. And he sees, in the way that the priest of that village, who was called Montpesson, and who've put a sort of cordon sanitaire around the village in order to protect all the, because what had happened was a bale of cloth had come from London and it had the plague bacillus in it. And it was a terrible time because a village, I can't remember how many inhabitants, but it's a small Derbyshire village, and huge, and the proportion of them died. And so you were living amongst corpses and you were digging graves, but they put this cordon sanitaire around them, to stop the people in the surrounding villages getting infected. And I was relating that, actually, now I look back at it, to the way that people with AIDS, working with, were protecting themselves and indeed others from being infected. And so far from being stigmatized by the rest of society, they should have been applauded for their courage in doing that.
I mean, in both the choice and the celibate, hearing you speak, I'm thinking that you have a vision, an ideology, a concept of something that crashes into reality. And in the choice, it's the concept of what things should be, and then all those different difficult choices on what they actually are and what you do about it. And in the celibate, he has this relationship with God, but then he sees the real world. My question to you, Michael, is at what stage, or was there a stage in your life that you had a vision of something that crashed into reality and made you what you are today?
Yes. Again, it relates to when you suddenly asked me about the biggest moral choice I'd had to face. I was extremely unwell in my early 20s. I'd gone on, through a minor public school through Cambridge. I'd been very involved in the theatre in Cambridge. I sort of saw myself in going into this rather straight trajectory to success in the artistic world as a playwright at the time. I was suddenly brought home because I had several years of serious illness. And everything changed at that. I had to confront who I was. I had to confront if I had a purpose in my life, and various other things. So yes, that was the time. And it seemed to me at the time to be completely wasted time. And when I came, sort of got out of it I'm about the age of 25, 26, I was very aware that my contemporaries and my friends were all on the, starting their careers and moving very happily on both their private and professional lives. And I felt very much left behind. And I thought I just completely wasted those 4 years. So to the annoyance of some of my friends, I used to just completely say, well, I'm actually 22 rather than 26.
but that was, and did that change your faith at all? Or how did it?
Well, I give a glib answer to that, I'm afraid, because I have been asked before, and I said I'd never stopped believing in God. I thought that God had stopped believing in me. There's a lot of truth in that. I just thought I was completely worthless and all the rest of it, but I didn't actually stop believing that there was a creative, loving power in the universe. I just thought I'd sort of fallen through the
you've been living. A couple of comments on the choice from our audience. CK, Christina, the nuanced approach to these fraught issues is what makes the choice such a good novel. It explores both Clarissa's personal dilemma and the wider question of what part, if any, morality plays in art. Yes, it makes the reader think and question his or her assumptions on that question. That's what we've been discussing. Thank you for that. Elizabeth Buchan, I echo Christina's comments above, but would add that the complicated issues are written about so clearly and humanely that I found it compulsive. So this is you drawing people in to what we've been discussing. And then Liz has just said, there must have been so difficult to cope with in your 20s. We're all so keen to get out there and start on our lives. That's a true one, isn't it? I wanted to go on to, the crashing of ideas and faith with reality, a particular interest to me, The Breath of Night, which is one of your earlier books. Julia Tremaine is a missionary priest in a remote Philippine village during the Marcos dictatorship. After championing the communist rebels, he finds himself imprisoned. Well, what drew you to that topic? Because I was very closely involved in that. The religion and insurgences, or Catholicism, particularly, and insurgences.
Well, it was an extension. My books had all taken place. I'd written a novel called Jubilati, which took place on a pilgrimage to Lourdes, which is a love story between a practicing Catholic and somebody who was a cradle Catholic, who is now a television director and had gone to make a film because it was set on the 150th anniversary of Lourdes. So, but other than that, all my novels had been domestic. I'd had various people, like all the many novelists, and certainly many of my wonderful friends who are novelists, I'd had my novels compared to those of, you know, many more celebrated novelists from the past. And the name,
thinking of Graham Greene, who has these strands,
regularly came up with Graham Greene and Iris Murdoch. I don't have Iris Murdoch's philosophical acumen, but I thought, well, I'll go to, you know, Graham Greene, you know, famously would go to Haiti or the Congo or wherever he went and see it and then create a novel through that. And I thought, well, I'll go to one of the, well, see, apart from East Timor, which is, I think, very, very small, the Philippines is the only Catholic country in Asia. So I know I'm right.
Yes, you are right.
So I thought that would be very interesting. It's hardly written about at all in Western literature. William Boyd wrote a novel that was set in the very early 20th century during the Spanish-American War, which involved the Philippines. James Patterson Hamilton, who lives there, had written some novels there. But it's not a place that has been well, you know, documented. I thought, well, I'll do have my own green moment, and I'll, you know, go to the Philippines. And I went on two separate occasions for 6 weeks, which may seem not enough time, but I got a lot of out of it. And I went to various parts of the Philippines, over 7,000 islands in the Philippines. And I went to several of them, including having a very nice holiday in the paradisical island of Boracay. But that had nothing to do with the book. Sorry, I'm just remembering it. And I discovered, as you will have done, this extraordinary place of contrasts, in that it is extremely, extremely Catholic. At the time, the Philippines, the Malta and the Vatican were the only states, I think I'm right in saying, certainly the only Christian states who wouldn't allow divorce. Nobody can have any sort of public life there unless they do embrace Catholicism. On the other hand, it is a place of terrible exploitation. And then during the book is partly set, I can't remember when it was written, but about 2010, 2011, and also set, as we said, in the Marcos dictatorship. And during the Marcos dictatorship, it was the time when there were these huge American bases, and there were 50,000 prostitutes in a city at the edge of one of these bases, which when I went to see, it's almost a ghost town. There are certain very few places left. But as well as that, there were appalling child exploitation. I saw this not in Manila or anywhere else, but I saw this at airports, where I remember being really sickened by seeing these very large men, often Australian, because Australians wear Australian sectorism, with these young kids. Well, I couldn't tell. It's also quite hard to tell ages, but I would have thought in their early teens. And it was quite clear that they were not adopted children. And when you know, you go from to the airport to go from island to island, and you would see them sitting there in the waiting room. And all the kids who were wearing these sort of flip-flops and very, when I say scanty, I don't mean they were undressed. I mean just a sort of shirt and very light trousers. And they were endlessly putting out their hands to the guys they were with for money to go to get Cokes and to get chocolate, where the vending machines. And the whole thing was, as far as I could see, and obviously I wasn't in any way involved in this, was that they wanted to get what they could. The important thing was to just get things. Even though they would drink the Coke or eat the chocolate, everything was contractual. It's a place of such contrasts. And of course, again, you have a priest at the center of it, who, you know, Christ's doctrine, as well as we know, it's complex. It's turn the other cheek, but at the same time, you know, it's also fight your enemies. But he was actually taking up arms, which is certainly against the hierarchy of the church, and many of us would say of the gospel. And yet the church was the opposition to Marcos. Nobody else was. Yes. He did some wonderful things. And the whole point is that somebody goes out there because people are claiming 20 years or 25 years on that there have been miracles at his grave. So somebody is sent out there to investigate whether he should be beatified. And obviously that's the first step to canonization. And then rather like, again, it's all about morality and about finding out more about people. Rather like in The Choice, we find out more about the artist who painted the panels of this church. In The Breath of Night, we gradually find out more about the priest, as well as about the whole society he lives in, and whether... What does this mean about for beatitude and canonization? Now, of course, in the Catholic Church, there are many people who've been canonized who we would not consider.
But the one thing when I was in the Philippines in the covering those post-Marcos years and some of the Marcos years is that the Catholic Church, as you say, understood the poverty and were deeply entrenched in those villages and linked to the communist insurgents. But the Protestant churches, much of it funded by the US, were building in those places their own things to attract people by offering them money. And when I talked to one of the Catholic priests and also one of the Protestant priests, I said, what is the difference? The thing that came out of that was that the Catholics are interested in day-to-day living in society, making society better. The Protestant ones that came in there, they were talking about the direct relationship between the individual and God. And when you were talking about the celibate there, Michael, and the man that the protagonist that dropped the wine, he was worried about his relationship with God, and then he understood his relationship with society.
The thing about being an Anglican, you know, it's the via media, is that you have both. I mean, those Protestants in the Philippines, who I had very few dealings with because they weren't coming into my book, but they were evangelicals.
Yes.
And there is, of course, an evangelical wing of the Church of England. And there's a very Anglo-Catholic wing of the Church of England. So you have both. You know, you have both the social aspect, and of course, the Christian socialism of the late 19th century was totally led by the Anglo-Catholic wing of the church. And you also have the Protestant, more Protestant side. The Catholics, I think you've given a very slightly rosier picture of what they did than I would. I mean, I totally believe the necessity at the time for this liberation theology that which the priest in my novel espouses during the Marcos era. But at the same time, you know, there are endless, you probably went to a lot of them, festivals in the Philippines. Every little village, and their festivals are the most extraordinary things. Fish festivals and tree festivals, as well as festivals of all the saints. I mean, there are more festivals, far more festivals than there are days of the year. I went to...
It's true.
One wonderful one on, I can't remember what the island was called, but it's the only place in the world where they have a festival just before Easter dedicated to Longinus. And he was the, if I'm right, I hope I pronounced the name right, but he was the Roman centurion who put the spear into Christ's side at the crucifixion. And one of the most extraordinary things there for me was that in this, this is a little island, it's not Manila, was that there's a procession of young women on the very, I mean, girls on the, through the streets, all dressed in white. I think they have, I can't remember, they have floral headdresses. Some of them were transsexuals or transvestites. They were operations then. And this was looked on in this tiny little rural community on this small island as something, again, you know, it was completely accepted. And the contradictions everywhere, the contradictions in Manila, which I found between people. I spent one day there when I went to, and you, I'm sure, did this, when I went to a school that was built on a rubbish dump. I mean, literally built on a rubbish dump. In the, and I wanted to give some money to a woman who was very heavily pregnant and holding another thing. And I feel ashamed to say this, but I had to give that money to my guide to go and give her because I couldn't get, the stench was so appalling that I couldn't get to where the part, I mean, I just couldn't go there. I'm not proud of that. But then in the afternoon, the evening, I went to a party in one of the grandest parts of Manila, where it's the only place I've ever been to where they had literally had gold taps. It was terribly hot. You go to parties in Manila, even smart parties, you wear sort of T-shirt type things. You don't wear jackets and ties. And all lining the thing between the very long drive between the road and the entrance were these flunkies dressed in sort of, you know, Louis says, three-cornered wigs and thick waistcoats and trousers, sweat pouring off them. Just, they were just decoration. They were holding up sort of...
Decorations for you.
Decorations for me. And inside's where I met Imelda Marcos as well, which was a very strange experience.
And how many shoes was she wearing?
They were very ordinary. I was very disappointed.
Before, because we're running a little, I wanted to talk to you. We've covered contradictions and dilemmas, but your life as a critic in the art world, separate from your novels and the faith we're talking about, what is that like? What got you into it? Do you enjoy it, or do you prefer writing?
I certainly prefer writing, and I do. I started, well, when I began my career, I thought I would be a playwright. I quickly realized that, not quickly enough, that such talents as I have are more discursive, as you've probably found this morning. I wasn't necessarily so good at concentrated thought. Also, I don't like conflict. And if you're, you know, writing drama, I mean, I like conflict in any shape and form. And if you're writing drama, it's conflict is de rigueur. And so I wrote quite a few plays successfully for the radio, and a few plays that went on blandly. I mean, they weren't unsuccessful, but they weren't, you know, hits for the stage. And then a very dear friend of mine, who was called Cassandra Jardine, who was the chief features writer for The Telegraph, I went to have dinner with her. Unfortunately, she died a few years ago, 11 years ago. And I went to have dinner with her. And at the time there was that she lodging with her was a man called Ian Irvin, who was the arts editor of the Evening Standard. And he was worried about there was a critic then called Milton Schumann, who was very old. They needed somebody else to be another person besides the deputy, because she was having to do a lot of the work, Milton, so they needed somebody to do her work. And you say, I don't know where. And Cassandra said, oh, you must have Michael. He knows all about the theatre. I wouldn't have dreamt of saying this. And a few days later, he asked me to go and review a play. And I had no idea. I mean, he said 500 words, and I sort of took this as a guideline. I had no idea then that you actually had to fit words into a particular. I had to read it. And I went to, I remember it was a play by the wonderful Canadian playwright, director, Robert Lepage. And I remember I had to read it. It was a time when you had to read your copy through to copy takers the next morning. Well, at the standard, it was before 7 o'clock because I think the first paper was out at 11 or 12. I can't remember. Yeah. I remember asking the woman to read it to me again to see, bring it back to me to check that I hadn't made some ghastly mistakes. And she was furious about this. Don't have time to do that sort of thing. And also, you know, you heard, I did this for several years with the copy takers. And, you know, your sort of slight witticisms fell like lead. So I got into it completely by chance. And then Milton Shulman retired. So I actually became more prominent than I'd expected. It was a good thing to do. And then my first novel, The Celibate, came out and was quite successful. And going to the theatre 3 or 4 times a week as I was doing and writing about it 3 or 4 times a week was quite stressful. So I gave it up. And I then wrote for many, many years, quite a lot of book reviews, which I enjoyed. And then I think about 2000, and I can't remember the exact day, 2014, the Sunday Express had lost a critic, theatre critic, and somebody remembered me and asked me if I'd like to do it. And it was perfect for me because it was much less prominent. It was one piece a week. I only had to see 2 plays a week. And it didn't interfere with my writing.
But you talked about doing being a book reviewer, which you are, and you also write books which are reviewed. And we all have heard stories about the authors getting dreadful reviews and sort of going into deep depression and that. When you're reviewing a book that you don't think is quite up to scratch or you think is absolutely wonderful, how much thought do you give to that, being an author yourself?
A lot. I very rarely now review a book that, I mean, I can't think of the last time I check carefully before I agree to review a book that is something I like. The one thing I refuse to accept is cynicism. If something is written cynically, mm-hmm. I.e. whatever else, or the book is pervaded by cynicism, then this hasn't happened for a long time, but then I'm very, very critical in the sense of attacking it. But very rarely, and I always try to see the positive thing. Partly there's very little space now for books in newspapers. It's a bit silly to write completely knocking reviews, or indeed half knocking, because
nobody's going to buy the book.
And I am very aware that how hurt I would be if someone was doing that to me. Yeah.
And what about puffing it too much? Would you say, well, that might be going, I really think this is great, but that might be going a little bit too much?
Well, I don't puff. I have a friend who says you should always give a quote, give a phrase that can be used as a quote on the cover. I review for the Financial Times and for the Spectator, both of them very serious journals, papers, and they don't want me just going, gosh, this is the best thing I've read for years, and they actually want an analysis of the book, a bit of the narrative of the book, and then an assessment of whether it works. It's rare that actually I don't like something that I'm reviewing.
I want you to sit there for a second because I'm going to tell people what is coming up. But before I do that, Liz says, I'm a lifelong fan of Graham Greene. Sadly, the print of my Penguin Classics collection is now too small to read. I love Our Man in Havana, also like William Boyd, who you mentioned. And Suri's watched a very moving movie last week called The Sound of Freedom about child exploitation. It's based on true stories. Storytelling is very good. I highly recommend it. Even at the end of the show, the audience stood up to clap. This is a big issue, isn't it? Before I get about, you know, minors, child exploitation of women in the Me Too movement.
Oh, yes. I mean, absolutely. We're much, much more aware of it now because people didn't talk about these things before. I mean, when I was growing up in the early 60s, when I was a child, little child, and my parents split up, people didn't talk about divorce, let alone about, you know, abusive marriages or abusive children. I was shocked, absolutely shocked. I was reading a book. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was about homosexuality in London from Regency period to the end of the 20th century. To read a comment that a judge made to two men who had been found having sex in a public lavatory or in a park or something like that, in which he sent them, I think he sent them both to prison. This was the 1950s. And he said, I could have understood if it had been a choir boy, but actually, you know, and you know, two grown men. And that was, and I mean, that's on public record, is in the book. And I thought, you know, what a turnaround now.
I could understand if it was a choir boy.
And that goes to the idea that, you know, boys like women are you know, young and so I sort of frail, vulnerable. It doesn't affect your masculinity. Two men is an abuse of masculinity. An abuse of a child is really the way things should be.
On that note, I'm going to give the promotions of what's coming up because my mind is buzzing with that. September the 12th, that is next week, live at Riverstone, Kensington. Lucinda is with Emma Byrne, who's a popular science author, on her new book, How to Build a Human. Well, we've been discussing a bit of that today. That is at Co House, Warwick Way, W14. Email Joe Carter-Hawkins at golster.co.uk to see there and see and to meet Emma and Lucinda. September 15th, Sarah Bax Horton and a new investigation into Jack the Ripper. September 16th, that is the next day, Lucinda is with Miranda Moore on morning rituals on how to best to live your morning before the busyness of life takes over. And September 28th, I'm with Austin Camacho, a Black American crime writer extraordinaire, with his new book, Subtle Felonies. And our book of the month on September 29th is Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, A Journey Deep into the Jungle and into Our Souls. It's a thin book. It's a great book. So have a read and come to discuss. Have you read Heart of Darkness, Michael?
Yes, I have, a long time ago. And I read all Conrad. And it is, as we know, a marvelous novel.
Yes. And do you have a morning ritual? We've got a book about morning. Is there something you do in the mornings to...
Well, I write in the mornings, and I write in bed, and so my only ritual is to get up at about 6:30, 6:45, have some herbal tea, go back to bed, start writing, and then have breakfast around 8:30, 9 o'clock.
Longhand or on your computer?
It depends what stage of a novel I'm at. I always write something in such scrawl that, of course, it's often illegible. Which may be a good thing. And then I put it on the sort of second, not even a second draft. It's the first draft just transferred to the computer. But
And you mentioned about in your 20s that life and death choice that you gave yourself, big moral challenge. And recently you've had some mobility issues too. And you said that you grew the beard because you were laid up. Give us a tip. You know, how do you keep your morale up when you're faced with these things?
Well, my 20s was rather different because my morale wasn't up. But now, I mean, creativity in any form. I mean, I'm lucky in that I am able to write. People on the whole want to see what I've written. And it's the most satisfying. But you creatively reading, creatively gardening, creatively whatever. That to me is to use that creativity, which, to go back to what somebody says in The Choice, is a very significant part of God. I mean, that I think is the greatest gift, and that's what gets us through. And the other thing that's got me through is that I've been very, very lucky. I've got some wonderful friends. And though I though I'm less housebound now, I'm still pretty housebound. And I was completely housebound for nearly a year. And I was very gifted, if you like, in the number of friends who came in the afternoons and things, which is was an enormous help.
And creativity. Goodness, lots of thank yous coming up. Interesting discussion. We'll definitely buy the book, says Anne. Geeta, thanks so much, Michael, Humphrey and Joe. Interesting interview. Christina, thank you. Stimulating a wide-ranging discussion. Maria, provoking, thought-provoking chat. Yes, I agree with all of that. That's it. Chimes Wing Chariot is attacking us. The wonderful and inspiring Michael Arditi with his web of moral choices and complexities of faith. What a great Goldster conversation you have given us. Until next week, when Lucinda is back from cruising around Britain, stay active, stay curious, stay involved, stay safe. And I have a new one. Stay creative. And of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, Michael Arditi, for being such a brilliant guest. And bye.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.